Miss Green?
Anya had been absorbed in the information that filled her notebook computer screen, but she shot back to reality and looked up at the man addressing her. After Joe had dropped her at a truck stop and wished her well, Anya had thanked him and caught a cab to the closest mall. She'd welcomed the air conditioning, and the bookstore had taken her mind off things for a bit. The man approaching her was in his late 30s or early 40s, a squared-off, compact man of average height. He wore jeans, a golf shirt, dark sunglasses, and a lightweight jacket. The man looked at Anya through his dark lenses, but the way he held his head told her that he also watched the mall traffic around them.
You don't know me, Miss Creed. Mr. Rue sent me. I'm supposed to escort you back to New York. Are you ready?
I am.
Anya closed down the files she'd been reading, put the computer away, then slung the backpack over one shoulder and stood. The man stepped back and nodded towards the exit.
This way, please. I've got a car and driver outside.
Sure.
Anya started walking, and the man fell into step just behind her and to her right.
Do you have a name?
Call me Ishmael.
Was that your idea or Rue's?
I'm known for my humor.
I'll bet you are. How long have you known Rue?
Not to be rude, Miss Creed, but that topic isn't open to discussion.
Don't worry. I figured as much.
The Revolver Club did feature a large pistol as part of its neon plumage. The image was engraved in electric blue and glowing black tubes. Bullet tips showed in the cylinders. This part of Shanghai had held a Western flavor as long as Kelly could remember. The English, French, and Americans had maintained an influence in the city since the early 1800s, and the youth of the city had always reached out to emulate them. A doorman stood guard at the club's entrance in the foyer. He grinned at Kelly, revealing betel-nut-stained teeth. She'd dressed like a party girl, wearing a bright red wig, cream-colored capris, and a revealing top. She didn't carry a pistol. If she needed one, she figured there would be plenty inside. She paid the entrance fee and walked in. The club was longer than it was wide. A dance platform supported two exotic dancers who looked enough alike to have been twins, or at least sisters. They started their routine dressed like high school cheerleaders, complete with pom-poms. However, they were disrobing in record time to the grinding beat of industrial metal music. A long bar filled the back of the club. Tables and chairs filled the empty space between the counter and the stage. Even though the club featured exotic dancers, there were almost as many women in the bar as men. According to Tse Chu Yu, the razor claws hung out at the Revolver Club. Kelly didn't know if the man who'd escaped her father's house was there, but right now, he was her only lead, and she had to check. The bag of bones her father had left her offered no clues, and Guy himself was too well protected. Swaying to the music, she kept watch over the crowd in the long mirror behind the bar.
Hey, baby! Let me buy you a drink!
Kelly turned to face the man next to her. He was in his early 20s, with slicked back hair, dark slacks, and a good shirt. She looked at his hands, noting the tattoos that showed across his knuckles.
I've already got one coming.
I'll buy you the next one. Maybe we can talk a little.
I'm not looking for a talk. I just stop in for a drink.
The guy made an exaggerated production of snapping a cigarette from a pack and lighting it. Smoke wreathed his head and he squinted.
You are dressed like someone who came in here for just a drink.
Maybe you're right. Can we go someplace where we can be alone?
My associates run this bar. We can go anywhere you want.
The hood took her by the hand and led her away from the bar to a small stockroom in the back. The man became aggressive at once, grabbing her like an animal. Kelly hit the guy in the throat with the Y between her thumb and forefinger, just hard enough to paralyze his lungs for a moment, but not kill. Sliding behind him, she wrapped an arm around his neck and shut off blood flow. The man's brain shut down in seconds, and he collapsed into a loose-limbed heap. As she searched him, Kelly watched the slow, rhythmic rise and fall of his chest. It reassured her that he was unconscious, not dead. Her search turned up a 9mm pistol with a full magazine. She made certain a round was under the hammer and that the weapon was double action. She crossed to the door and locked it. Looking around, she found an electrical cord sitting on one of the metal shelves. Working quickly, she tied her captive's hands behind his back, then tied his feet together. A quick search of the shelves turned up a bottle of astringent pine-scented cleaner. She shoved her finger into the bottle and wet it with the cleaner, then smeared it under the unconscious man's nose.
What's going on?
Kelly rapped him between the eyes with the pistol just hard enough to get his attention.
I'm looking for someone.
Jim Wren!
Calmly, Kelly shoved the pistol barrel against the man's head.
Shut up and listen. The man I'm looking for killed an old man over in the Bund this morning. The murder was arranged by Guy Kuan Yin.
Kelly silenced the hood by pushing the pistol against his lips.
Think before you speak. If you tell me you don't know who this man is, I will kill you instead of him. Tell me his name.
Meng. His name is Meng.
Is he here?
No.
Where can I find him?
In the birdcage. It's a bar 2 blocks north of here.
Taking a bar towel from a stack on the shelf, Kelly shoved it into the man's mouth and tied it in place with the electrical cord. She took an apron from the shelves, too, and folded the pistol in the material. Now that she was armed and ready for action, it was time to find Meng. After taking a few minutes to steel herself, Kelly had walked up to the entrance of the birdcage. Her pistol was tucked into the apron, and vengeance burned inside her. She was calm, collected, and ready for retribution. She had hoped to enter unhindered, but a massive bodyguard stepped in front of her just as she was about to pass through the door.
Where are you going?
I have to cover a shift.
I don't recognize you.
I can go home.
Yunhu?
It is only my first day.
Tell them to send me a drink when you get in there.
Okay.
Kelly stepped inside. She knew that the clock was working against her. At any moment, someone could discover the man she'd left tied up at the revolver club. He would know exactly where she was. The birdcage had 2 ornate 6-foot birdcages hanging from the low ceiling, and 2 women in garish costumes stood gyrating inside each. Blacklight strobed the walls, illuminating dragons, tigers, and other mythical creatures. Kelly swept the bar with her gaze and recognized Meng immediately. He was sitting at a circular back table. He had 2 young women seated on either side of him. All of them were laughing, but only he was talking. Keeping the pistol covered in the apron, Kelly made her way around the dance floor to his table. Meng was young and thin, with black hair that hung down to his shoulders. He wore slacks and a nice turtleneck under a red leather jacket. The young women fawned over him, both of them barely clothed. Kelly sat down across the table from Meng, keeping her hands below the table and her pistol gripped tight in her right hand. She had no intention of letting the animal live, not after the hard way her father had died. Gradually, despite the feminine distraction, Meng's attention turned to Kelly. He frowned, narrowing his bleary, drunken eyes.
Do I know you?
You killed my father this morning.
Meng tried to get to his feet, but Kelly planted a foot in the middle of his groin. A second kick thrust him back against his seat, sending the women scurrying away. Kelly revealed the 9mm she'd taken, poking the tip of the muzzle just above the table's edge.
If you go for a weapon, I am going to kill you. Keep your hands on the table where I can see them. Now. Who sent you to kill my father?
You're in way over your head.
I am not the one about to die at this table if he doesn't start talking. You don't have much time.
Kelly tracked the progress of the young women as they made their way across the club toward the nearest bouncer. Kelly gestured towards them with the pistol. Sweat rolled down Meng's face from the alcohol and fear. His hands trembled on the table.
Once the girls stop to talk to someone, if you haven't answered my questions, I am going to kill you.
Guy sent us.
To kill my father.
No. We were supposed to find something. The old man, your father, wouldn't cooperate. It wasn't me who tortured him or killed him, though.
What were you supposed to find?
Some kind of bag. It was supposed to have bones or something in it.
How did Guy know about the bag?
I don't know. Please believe me.
I do. But only because you are too much of a coward to lie. What were you supposed to do with the bag?
Oh, just get it and bring it to Guy.
From the corner of her eye, Kelly saw the young women stop by the door and hesitate. She could tell that they were deciding between fleeing for their own lives or trying to help Meng. Finally, they headed toward the bar, evidently spotting someone they knew. Kelly scanned the rest of the room, spotting an exit at the back.
Please, don't kill me. I can tell you something else.
Make it quick.
Guy is also interested in work being done out of Lulan City.
Lulan City? Where is that? Are you lying to me?
I swear, it's real. It's an ancient city in the desert.
What work is going on there?
The government has an archaeological team out there. Some guy named Hu is in charge. They are looking for something Guy is interested in.
And what would that be?
I don't know.
The young women were now talking to three men at the bar. They gestured wildly in Kelly's direction. For just a moment, Kelly was undecided about whether or not to kill Meng. She kept remembering how her father's body had looked. But she'd come home to get away from all the violence, and she'd already ended two lives that morning. Without a word, Kelly stood, concealed the 9mm in the folds of the apron again, and left the table. The three men from the bar were now muscling their way across the dance floor. Their hands slid beneath their jackets for weapons they carried. The crowd split apart as the massive thugs advanced across the room. Meng stood. Kelly knew he was torn between reclaiming his honor and preserving his life. He made the wrong decision. His hand shot for the pistol at the back of his pants. Still on the move, Kelly pointed her pistol at him as he brought his Glock up to firing position. He let off two hurried shots. Two bystanders on either side of Kelly collapsed. Kelly paused, took deliberate aim, and shot Meng between the eyes. Kelly ran, vaulting over patrons as she made for the club's back door. She hit the panic bar and crashed through, emerging into the dark alley. She got her bearings, looking to both ends of the alley and the streets beyond, then ran. The triad gunman didn't reach the alley until she was already turning the corner. They fired at her, the bullets going wide and striking a passing car and the buildings across the street. The car veered into another and created an immediate traffic snarl. Kelly kept running, putting more distance between herself and her pursuers. She had a direction now, though she didn't know what connection the archaeological dig at Lulan City had to Guy. What she did know was that there was only one way to find out. Anya woke in darkness and remembered at once she was on a plane. The man who had picked her up at the mall sat across the aisle of the private jet Rue had arranged for her. He calmly glanced over a copy of Scientific American.
It's all right, Miss Creed. Just a bit of turbulence.
Lifting the window cover, Anya peered out at the night. Bursts of white-hot lightning split the sky, leaving everything pitch black in its absence.
Pilot's getting clearance to get us out of this.
How long have I been asleep?
Yeah, a few hours. We've got a couple more hours until we reach New York. Anyway, I'm going to eat. Would you like something?
Sure.
As Ishmael headed for the galley, Anya stretched, rubbed her eyes, and reached for her computer. As usual, she checked her news groups first.
I've been searching all over for more information about the legend associated with the belt plaque you posted. I haven't been able to find much more, but don't be disappointed. I'm still looking.
Anya couldn't help but be discouraged. She had been hoping for a new lead to chase, but this left her wondering where to turn next. An instant message box suddenly popped up on the computer screen. It was from the website poster.
Are you online?
Yes.
I was about to post, saw you online, and thought I'd IM instead. Is that okay?
It's okay. I appreciate everything you're doing. This thing has been difficult to research.
That's probably because you're going through regular history and archaeological sites to try to find answers.
I am.
I'm not. I've been noodling around in conspiracy sites, and some on myth and lore. Not exactly verifiable.
This was precisely the kind of research Chasing History's Monsters did, and Anya couldn't help but be displeased. She knew that sorting through that kind of material and distinguishing fact from fiction could be particularly challenging.
I wasn't looking in that direction.
I figured as much. It's not everybody's cup of tea. Do you know who the Pengli are?
I thought that was a city.
There is a city, but the city took its name from a myth about Pinglai Mountain. That's where the eight immortals were supposed to live. They were thought to be based on eight wise men and women. All of them were supposed to be forces of good. Pinglai Mountain has existed as a myth since the Qin Dynasty.
That puts us at 250 years BC. That time frame coincides with the rise of Scythian art.
Indeed. Emperor Qin Shi Huang sent several explorers looking for Pinglai Mountain, where palaces were made of platinum and gold and jewels grew on trees. And, of course, there was the elixir of life that granted eternal youth.
Then I understand how Emperor Qin could have been motivated.
Right. But the thing that interested me was the myth of the ninth immortal. While Emperor Qin's warriors were out searching, they sailed through a storm and ended up on a beach of white sand on an uncharted island.
Did they find palaces of gold or platinum?
No, but they did find what some people believe was the ninth immortal. The other eight immortals are viewed as heroes, forces for good. This one wasn't a hero. This one was death. He begged the warriors to rescue him. They granted his wish and brought him back to the emperor's court. The ninth immortal called himself Sha Wu Ying, which means dancing shadow of death. Upon meeting Qin, he revealed himself to be an assassin, perhaps the most dangerous ever. He offered his services to Qin and proved his worth by killing two of the emperor's enemies. The legends become less consistent at this point in history. Some say he decided to take on other clients, and others that he had a love affair with one of the emperor's wives. Whatever it was, Emperor Qin tried to have him killed.
That didn't work out.
No. Have you read how Qin died?
He died from taking mercury.
Yes. Qin was obsessed with death. He kept sending people out looking for the elixir of life. Allegedly, his court physician was giving him immortality pills. Historians figured they were mercury. But what if Sha Wu Ying arranged for the court physician to give Qin mercury, knowing it would kill him?
It's a fact that Emperor Qin was the target of several assassins.
There was one man named Zhang Liang who became the most dedicated assassin pursuing Qin. Zhang himself had to flee the emperor's wrath because of the threat he posed. Now, while he was running, he met an old man who gave him a book. Legend has it that Zhang used the techniques in the book while he served as military advisor to Liu Bang and helped establish the Han Dynasty.
I'm not sure what this has to do with the Scythian belt plaque, though.
Suppose instead of an old man giving the book to Zhang, it was actually Sha Wu Ying.
Is there anything to indicate that?
Nothing concrete, but look at the circumstantial evidence. Sha Wu Ying was a trained assassin. That probably means he had military experience, too. Zhang got that book on military strategy from someone who had reason to want Qin out of power. From what I've been able to read between the lines, Sha Wu Ying later became the head of a criminal cabal located on the Silk Road. The cabal was an entire cult of assassins, hiring out their skills to warlords and members of the court. Their symbol was the tiger carved on that belt plaque.
Can you send me your research?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Maybe you can do more with it than I can. At this point, I'm stuck. If something else breaks, I'll let you know.
Anya logged off the page and opened her email server to wait for the arrival of the documents. Her mind buzzed with everything he'd discovered. She couldn't understand why Huang Fu Cao wanted a belt plaque that might be connected to an assassin's cult. Was it a valuable artifact in its own right? Did the inscription on the back hold something more than just the curse? Anya set the computer aside and stood to get a bottle of water from the galley. Only one thing was certain. She had many more questions than answers.
Rogue Angel is continued on the next CD.
Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm Amanda Huggenkiss. Our top story tonight is the new graphic audio podcast. We go live to Bill Periwinkle.
I'm live here on the streets and people have gone crazy. They're so excited about these new graphic audio podcasts, they've started rioting.
This is awesome! I love graphic audio.
I'm bulletproof. Yeah, graphic audio.
The people demand graphic audio.
These people can't get enough graphic audio. Back to you, Amanda.
Thanks, Bill. When we come back, Killer Stickies attack Tom Bruise.